Hello and welcome to this late night debate night 538 politics podcast. I'm Galen Druk. Tonight was the last Democratic primary debate before the Iowa caucuses, and the candidates debated topics like foreign policy towards Iran and whether a woman can win the 2020 election. So let's talk about how it all went down, and here with me to do that, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. How's it going?
It's going good. All of us are quite sick in different ways. I don't know if it's the Russians hacking 538 or what. I guess it sounds a little bit like Bernie Sanders or something, but yeah, we're doing the best we can. This might be on the short side this episode.
We're all in different forms of sickness at the moment, so bear with us. Claire Malone, senior politics writer, how are you?
I'm good. I love this impromptu meditation on the fragility of human beings. I'm sorry you're both feeling sick.
I don't get sick very often, so I forget how awful it is to be sick.
Amen. It is terrible. I maybe sound more normal than you do, Nate, but I had food poisoning, which was really something to overcome this afternoon.
Aww. So, poor
but
baby.
We're here in any case. Okay, so let's get to it. What were your top line takeaways from tonight's debate? Let's start with you, Claire.
Well, to be honest, it was mostly kind of like a snoozeville debate. I guess the big thing that will be, you know, played in on cable and will be headlined is kind of the direct confrontation, if we can call it that, between Sanders and Warren over the idea of can a woman be president? And it kind of, you know, it was interesting for a little bit, but then kind of things moved away. I guess we did do a lot of talking about foreign policy at the top of the debate, and Sanders kind of tried to differentiate himself from Biden, say, as a non-interventionist kind of candidate. But overall, I didn't necessarily think it will necessarily move the needle for any one person, which I know sounds like a typical 538 cop-out about, oh, we got to see the data. But I don't know. It didn't really particularly strike me as anyone's night in particular.
Yeah, Nate, I want to get to your takeaways, but why do you think there wasn't more conflict? I mean, you know, the media has an incentive to frame the debate as, oh, it's going to be a big one. But it really, they didn't seem to go after each other in very direct ways.
It's a bit weird that Biden has been the front runner in the polls, national polls anyway, throughout, right? And, as you know, except for Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, has never taken that much incoming fire from like the other top four candidates or the top three apart from Biden, right? And, you know, even tonight, the disagreements were fairly cordial. I don't know. I mean, I think there's like this bit of conventional wisdom that you are hurt if you attack Biden. And people give the example of Kamala Harris. Well, I don't know about that. We've talked about that on this show before, where Kamala Harris like went from like 6% to 18% and then fell back down to 12%. Okay, it's like still not bad, right? She still rose and was net positive relative to not attacking Biden. So, but anyway, yeah, it's like the last real opportunity to kind of scathe Biden before Iowa, although Iowa maybe is not his most important state. Maybe it's South Carolina or something, and people did not really take advantage of it.
Yeah. So what ended up being your takeaway, given the lack of conflict?
I mean, I think there are three ways to read it. One is to say, hey, look, it was a little bit of an anticlimactic debate. The moderation was not that sharp. It's a little overshadowed by impeachment. The first 45 minutes were on foreign policy stuff where voters may not care that much, frankly. So one interpretation is that it's a nothing burger. Interpretation number two is that maybe Warren won, to the extent that the media plays up the Warren-Sanders conflict. I mean, it was a very weird moment where, like, first of all, like, the moderator kind of presumed in the question she asked to Warren that, like, hey, look, well, he told you this, then tell me about that, right? Instead of, like, even though Bernie had refuted that moments earlier, that was strange, right? This other strange exchange about, like, the 30 years, right? But I did think, like, you know, it's harder for Bernie to look good on that question for various reasons, number one. And she came prepared with, I thought, a very smart answer about electability, Warren did. She also got Bernie testifying now that a woman is electable. And I thought Warren was also sharp at other points in the debate. She got to talk about childcare and the wealth tax issues that back when she was kind of polling as a frontrunner, were issues voters liked. Interpretation number three is that Biden won for the reasons I was talking about before, where, hey, look, if the frontrunner is unscathed, then it helps him. Biden was, I think he kind of seemed like a little sleepy, but he was never really knocked off kilter. And so if you're like an establishment Democrat wavering on Biden before, you'd be like, you know what? He's gotten more solid and steady at these things. I don't really know that I, if you're an establishment Democrat, you might not like Warren or Bernie, and you might not be ready to trust Mayor Pete, right? And Bloomberg, well, who the hell knows, right? So it might kind of further stiffen up establishment support for Biden. But like, but my priors are fairly weak here. You know, it kind of seems like we take these podcasts right after the debates happen. It kind of seems like reading the Twitter feed, which is always dangerous. It kind of seems like that Warren interpretation might be the one that clicks in the media a bit, but that's an early guess.
Yeah, what do you make of that, Clay?
I think I go back to it was a pretty dull debate, and Biden didn't have any major flubs. He kind of, like I was just saying before, he kind of skated through. I think Sanders kind of performed well where he needed to. You know, he always has a couple moments every debate where he kind of can go on a bit of a polemical roll, and he did that. And then Warren also had her kind of moment to say, yes, a woman can be president, that kind of thing. It seemed to kind of be a wash to me, and a wash kind of favors the people who are, you know, the current polling leaders. So
can I break some news here?
Go for it.
It turns out this is stupid, but people will be talking about it by the time they hear this podcast. There was an exchange after the debate ended between Bernie and Biden where they refused to shake hands, or at least chose not to shake hands. And there was a lot of tension in their body language, and people are talking now about, like, what were they saying? I mean, clearly, you don't have to be a body language expert to see, like, it seemed like a somewhat tense exchange. So that might affect the way this thing is covered by the press.
That's interesting. I kind of wonder what that's about. But we don't know.
Because they didn't seem to particularly go after each other. I mean, they disagreed, but it wasn't in super direct or personal ways.
What was interesting to me this week was, so Sanders had this call script for volunteers where it was like, okay, if someone's considering voting for Warren and you want to convert them to Sanders, here are your talking points, right? Frankly, those seem like very normal talking points, right? And the talking points were that, like, well, she's a candidate of well-educated voters and we need the working class, right? Which is also somewhat true in polls. And Warren seemed genuinely pretty upset about that, which is just kind of standard boilerplate campaign strategy. And so I don't know, right?
By the way,
if she thinks that...
There's another video now I'm seeing on Twitter of Sanders and Warren. And Bernie kind of starts to extend his hand to shake hers, and she kind of doesn't take it and then kind of starts.
Oh, that's what I was talking about. Did I say Biden and Warren? No, it's Bernie. It's Bernie and Warren. Oh, where if I said Biden, there are too many B's. No, the video I'm talking about is Bernie and Warren having this apparently testy exchange, right? At minimum, they did not shake hands. I feel like a freaking like theater critic here. But clearly, if the question is this all kind of, what's the word, kefabe or whatever kind of fake conflict, or is it real? I mean, that would up your prior that it's real and would lend more attention to the exchange over is a woman electable as opposed to other parts of the debate.
The obvious takeaway from conflict between Warren and Sanders is that it would help Biden in splitting the progressive vote. Is there any reason to double check that take, or is this all good for Biden?
People are weak. People are too afraid of conflict. Galen and Claire.
shut up.
You know, I mean, look, you usually want, no, I don't mean you. I'm saying like people in general.
I was making a funny, Nate.
I mean, so look, you want a measured amount of negative campaigning or conflict because it can be a little bit mutually destructive, right? But if you have a candidate who you feel like has arguments that voters aren't hearing, and they need to be kind of put out into the ether, right? The funny thing is that Sanders, despite being a plausible nominee the whole time, Has not really been treated as a front runner until recently. We can debate the reasons for that. We can debate how much has actually changed, right? But like, but you know, he has not gotten until like this week where it kind of flipped on lots of issues. And so Warren kind of saying, you know, maybe I want to circulate a few things and at least kind of change the current narrative. By the way, one thing that can happen is that when there's a lot of press coverage over Warren and Sanders, well, maybe then like a Buttigieg voter or a Klobuchar voter says, you know what, it seems like these two and Biden are the candidates that are getting talked about, right? I want my vote to be viable. So I don't know. I think it's like a little bit more complicated than people always bring up kind of Gephardt versus Lieberman, like it's the canon, the only way this can work out, right? There have been lots of negative moments and lots of negative campaigning in other campaigns, right? Campaigns seem to figure out that you need a mix of mostly positive in primaries and some negative. People are so pearl-clutching about any negativity.
Yeah, but let me just jump in here, Nate, and push back a little bit, which is like, does this entire incident look good for either Warren or Sanders' campaign? I mean, like, on the one hand, I guess it, I mean, I think, let's assume for a second that perhaps on some level, Sanders expressed the sentiment that a woman would have a difficult time winning the presidency against Trump. I think a lot of voters think that. And so on some level, maybe people will kind of say, well, maybe Bernie speaks the truth and it's an uncomfortable truth, but he's right and Warren's not electable. Or he comes off looking pretty bad and Warren comes off looking like, you know, crusading person. But that's
but
a little
I
hard
think
for...
That, I think the electability thing is always in the back of voters' heads. And it's not clear to me that, like, making it more explicit is bad for Warren, and you could argue the opposite, right? You could argue that she's kind of forcing voters to confront the idea that, hey, I like Warren, but I'm not, because there are a lot of voters like that, right? But
of
she's
course,
making
yeah.
voters confront the idea that, hey, I am not sure that a woman's electable, but like, I'm also not sure that's the result of years of misogyny, and I'm not sure that, like, you know, I don't know, maybe you re-examine that prior, right? Because it's not like electability is an issue that ever fades away for Democratic voters. It's always quite top of mind. And if it's always quite top of mind, then maybe you want to kind of ask voters to check their priors. And maybe you also want to make a case about, like, hey, in 2018, all these women got elected. Hey, you know, the women on stage have won more races recently than the guys. So, you know, I thought the follow-up Warren had on electability was one of the better versions of the argument that she had.
To that point, the question about the meeting between Sanders and Warren and the comment that might have been made about whether or not a woman would be electable in 2020 got all of the men on stage talking about whether or not a woman is electable and largely making the case that, yes, a woman is electable in 2020. I mean, what kind of arguments were they making, and were they based in good kind of electoral analysis? They were basically making arguments that you would hear perhaps on the 538 Politics podcast, looking at past elections and data to try to
make their cases. Yeah, it was a bit horse racy, but like...
They were backed into the answer. They had to say that, right? Who up on a Democratic primary stage is going to say, you know what? I don't actually think a woman can win this time. You know, like, they kind of had to.
Right.
It was a...
Of course, but were they good answers, I guess, is the question.
Well, I think it's kind of... I mean, sure, on some sense, it's like always, like, having a track record of winning elections is a good thing. But also, I think there's something... you know, sui generis about this kind of presidential election, right? And that it's a different climate than running for Senate in a state, even though Senate is obviously a big office. So I do think that there's lots of other things that are sort of loaded onto the presidency that women candidates have to battle against. And so I'm not entirely... I take the arguments. Sure, they're data, right? But I think there are lots of different kinds of offices, and those races are formed by really particular forces. And right now we're in a time where I think there's more open... I wouldn't say... there's always been open sexism, but there's more open kind of navel-gazing about the effects of sexism and sort of frankness about sexism rather than this sort of like rah-rah, you go girl 2016 energy. So I think that's my pushback to the sort of those arguments that were made on stage.
I want to continue this conversation in just a minute, but first, today's podcast is brought to you by Upstart. Between hitting the gym, eating healthier, or learning a new skill, there are lots of ways we can better ourselves in the new year. One way of doing that can be tackling high-interest credit card debt. Upstart.com is here to help. Upstart is the revolutionary lending platform that offers smarter rates to help you pay off high-interest credit card debt. Upstart goes beyond the traditional credit score when assessing your credit worthiness. They actually reward you based on your education and job history in the form of a smarter rate. The best part, once the loan is approved and accepted, most people get their funds the very next business day. Over 400,000 people have used Upstart to pay off credit cards or meet their financial goals. Free yourself from the burden of high-interest credit card debt by consolidating everything into one monthly payment with Upstart. See why Upstart is ranked number one in their category with over 300 businesses on Trustpilot, and hurry to upstart.com/politics to find out how low your Upstart rate is. Checking your rate only takes a few minutes. That's upstart.com/politics. Today's podcast is also brought to you by SimpliSafe. SimpliSafe Home Security is like getting commercial-grade, enterprise-level security, but for your own home. Think about the security Fortune 500 companies use. They need to know the police are going to be on the scene immediately, and that's exactly the kind of security you get with SimpliSafe. If there's a break-in, SimpliSafe uses real video evidence to give police an eyewitness account of the crime, and that means police dispatch up to 350% faster than for a normal burglar alarm. With SimpliSafe, you get comprehensive protection in your phone. Outdoor cameras and doorbells alert you to anyone approaching your home. Entry, motion, and glass break sensors guard inside. It's all monitored 24/7 by live security professionals. You can set up your system yourself with no tools needed, or SimpliSafe's experts can do it for you. And it's only 50 cents a day with no contracts. Go to simplisafe.com/politics today to get free shipping on your order, plus a 60-day money-back guarantee. That's simplisafe.com/politics to save on home security today. simplisafe.com/politics. All right, we're back. And before we wrap up the part of our conversation about a woman being electable in 2020, Nate, did you have any follow-up to what Claire was saying before the break?
I mean, like, we try not to lean too heavily into electability stuff at 538. It's up to the voters to decide, and everything is kind of murky. I mean, you know, look, I tend to think that one of the things that's more empirically valid that I said before is that other things being held equal, candidates who are perceived as more moderate are more electable, other things held equal, which would tend to help neither Sanders or Warren in particular. But as a matter of rhetoric, I thought Warren articulated a pretty good version of the case for herself, and like reminding voters that women did really well in 2018. And by the way, one of the propositions that I think is least empirically proven, at least, is that the notion that like women are less electable. Of course, a lot of people believe that for lots of reasons, including, yeah.
We write about electability all the time. I mean,
we could go a lot more heavily on electability. We're not telling people who to vote for. We're not projecting.
No, that's not what electability
means. Running polling
means.
Averages for the general election.
Nate, that's not what electability means, right? That's endorsing someone. We write about electability and we parse through it because it's an entrenched, entwined idea in this election, and there's no way around it. There's a difference between endorsing a candidate and talking about electability, because electability in and of itself is sort of this, you know, is it a social construct, right? I think, yes, it is, right? But it's a social construct that takes on great meaning. And so we have to talk about electability. So that's just a kind
of... It's not a social construct. It's just like...
Yeah, sure it is. I mean, I think it is, right? Like, what is... You wouldn't know what... I think a lot of people take electability to be a euphemism for...
Well, if you study
dozens
of congressional races or hundreds of them, I mean, it's not really studyable for the presidency because you have too few sample sizes, right?
Sure.
But for Congress or governors, it's studyable. And there are lessons from that. And I don't really think those lessons apply to how voters think about them. And so I don't really choose to talk about them that much, right?
Other people on your site do, though. Yeah, I mean, I know what you mean, sure. But I think we as people who write and think and report on the election have to tangle with that and have to tangle with what the meaning is and what meaning American voters have put into the concept of electability. It wasn't, you know, it's not, you don't find it in the dictionary, and it's the data from gubernatorial races for the last 20 years, right? It's taken on a very particular patina in the four years since 2016.
So we need a new word for it, because to me, electability means who's most likely to win an election against a Republican.
And I think that's a very a very particular interpretation of the phrase.
Okay.
The word.
So, but that's the right, like, that's a dictionary definition of electability, right? So
that's what I mean. Where it's a social construct, because we've put a meaning into it in our politics.
But it's not. It's like saying that if you like reject the notion of color and say that color is a social construct. Well, no, color is a wavelength, right? It's mathematical. The way we construe color is a social construct, and some societies have three shades of blue, or they have green and blue together, or whatever else, right?
But listeners, like, I think we have bored into the fundamental differences in the way Nate and I think about things.
I'm just saying there is something real there. It's murky, but it's real. But like, you
right,
know.
We have, just to clarify here, I think we have some form of objective electability and what voters perceive as electable. And voters may not always be right in terms of what they perceive as electable. And we're finding out that, you know, throughout this primary, voters are telling reporters out in the field what they view as electable. And it, and for example, in this case, it doesn't necessarily line up with what we know from the data, which is that when women run, they win just as often as men do.
But not the presidency.
And again, we don't know if that applies to the presidency.
I think it does get murky. We don't have a women president yet. So, I mean, I think we should move on from this, but perhaps do a whole podcast about it. But I do kind of disagree.
Let's do a whole
I think I have a pretty strong agreement here, but we should move on and talk more about the debate.
In any case, this was the first time that the candidates really spent any time on the debate stage talking about foreign policy at length. How did that shake out? I mean, at some point it turned into an argument over the Iraq War, or at least commentary on the Iraq War. Is that still the lens that we're viewing our foreign policy through?
I mean, it doesn't seem to have hurt Biden that much so far, in part because Biden's given answers that are a little bit deceptive, really, where he's kind of, you know, barely even admitting he voted for the authorization to use force in Iraq.
It's still the prism through which we see a lot of foreign policy debates in the past decade in American presidential elections, because it sort of boils down to, should we be interventionist or should we be either non-interventionist or scale back, right? And so I think that's, in that sense, the war in Iraq continues to have effects.
But, I mean, but are voters punishing Biden for his past transgressions is the question, right? Because right now, he's saying...
And I take your point. I think I said this to you on the live blog. I mean, I think I take your point that he is not being punished for his Iraq war vote. But I also think that there's something interesting about Biden as a candidate in that some of his reputation was potentially laundered by his association with Obama, right? The idea that before he was Barack Obama's vice president, for instance, he didn't have all that strong of black voter support, right? You know, he had run for president before and he didn't have much black voter support at all. And I think the same thing with, you know, the Iraq war vote kind of gets obscured by, well, then he went to work for, you know, a president who was against the Iraq war and who, you know, tried to negotiate with Iran, tried to sort of broker some sort of peace in the Middle East.
Look, I do think it's Bernie's strongest argument vis-a-vis. Has anyone actually said the word vis-a-vis out loud before? I want to be the first. I think it's Bernie's strongest argument vis-a-vis Biden, RE foreign policy. You know, it is a contrast. It was a very
popular... Did you take too much Sudafed tonight, Nate? Is Nate, like, tripping right now?
Don't make me laugh. It, like, physically hurts to laugh. No, I think Bernie was smart. By the way, I don't think Bernie had a bad debate. I just think probably Warren had a better debate, and kind of there's a narrative that's pitting them against one another, and, you know. But I thought Bernie was smart to lead with Iraq on the questions about foreign policy. You know, frankly, after that question and kind of after the first 40 minutes of it, I'm not sure voters were paying much attention. in the Google Trends.
Did they differentiate themselves much? I mean, they all, whether or not they voted for the war in Iraq, they all agreed that they were, at this point, opposed to what had happened and wanted to pare down American presence in the region. Was there any clear differences?
Clear differences in framing. I mean, you know, Bernie's saying, I've been on the right side of these arguments from the start, and Biden's saying, I've been there, I'm experienced, but just saying, I've been there in a different way. Warren is saying, you know, this is kind of part of the overall problem, how much we're spending and these wars are bad, right? I mean, they all seem fairly consistent with their message, right? So, I'm not sure that voters are going to, like, kind of parse the finer points of distinction here. If you look at kind of Google search traffic for the candidates in the debate, usually when the debate starts, there's like a giant spike. But in the first 30 minutes, there really weren't. People were not paying that much attention to the foreign policy segments from what we can tell.
I mean, were you able to detect significant differences there or even like a winner in the foreign policy section of the debate, Clay?
No, not really. I mean, I think this is what in part what makes the debates dull from the sense of differentiation, right? I think it's good for the American people to like know what these six people who are running for president think about the world. But really, they disagree on domestic issues. I think, you know, interestingly, the foreign policy, the Iraq war stance, provides Sanders a way to pivot into his general election electability argument, which is kind of, I will appeal to those Trump voters who wanted to get out of wars in the Middle East, who wanted his idea of, like, we need to focus that on home, right? It's not the sort of like non-xenophobic version of that Trump
America first.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, I'm not sure that the debates, you know, as always, it comes down to the fundamental friction point in the Democratic Party, which is the debate over healthcare, which I'm not necessarily sure is the best from the Democrats' strategic point of view. One would think that they should be perhaps pushing the line a bit harder on, you know, the wealth tax stuff or, you know, systemic overhauls or regulations on big financial institutions. But healthcare is the big one that they tend to talk about here. So, don't know.
Yeah. Wrapping up here, you know, we've pointed out in previous podcasts, as have a lot of commentators, that the stage had six candidates who were all white after a historically diverse field. You've heard that phrase a lot. Was it apparent in the way that the candidates on stage did or didn't talk about race? I mean, did it change the conversation of the Democratic Party now that all of the candidates on stage were white?
I'm sure it did in lots of ways that as an all-white panel of three people, we're not even fully accounting for, right? You know, there were not a lot of questions framed around race. There were not a lot of cases where candidates brought up race unprompted. Actually, Buttigieg did once at the end. And so, yeah, but I'm sure it influences things. And again,
yeah.
I said this on the podcast Monday. Yeah.
It was brought up during discussions of like climate change, right, where people were saying minority communities are the ones that are most affected by, you know, pollution and climate change. But it wasn't necessarily like the framing of any one of these particular candidates up on stage, right? I mean, I think so. That's certainly notable that it wasn't kind of like a, you know, I am leading with this. I am bringing it up in each of my answers is because I'm speaking to constituencies that I think the Democratic Party needs to, you know, win over. But Buttigieg was certainly notable for kind of like the self-conscious. Yes, I realize that I have a problem with black voters, and here I am showing you how I'm working to address it.
Yeah. All right. Well, any other closing notes as we end our late night podcast?
So I would note
other
that,
than get well soon.
Yeah. I would note that debates, somewhat apart from the actual substance of the debate, are often just an excuse for the media narrative to change, right? And that could happen here. I mean, I think the media narrative recently has been like, oh, Bernie is looking pretty frisky. Maybe he is a front runner or the front runner. There's a chance that changes. Does that matter? I don't know. But Warren's campaign has been a little dismissed. And even though her, you know, she's not that far behind Sanders, at least in Iowa and New Hampshire or national polls, right? She's like 3 points behind him, right? Those are important points. I mean, our model gives Sanders not quite double, but a significantly higher chance to win the nomination than Warren. But if she were to gain 3 points nationally and tie him in national polls, then they'd be, you know, even with one another again in our forecast. So I don't know. I mean, I think she had, at the minimum, a pretty good night, maybe better than pretty good. And it's a well-timed pretty good night.
There you go. Claire?
Mostly I'm just, like, watching this Warren Sanders moment on repeat and just wondering how this is going to play out over the next 20 days. It's not a deep thought, but it's the one that's that's at the top of my head.
Well, listeners, I was going to say, stick with us, and you will find out how it plays out over the next 20 days. We've got a lot more
if we haven't died first.
I'll die.
Knock on wood, Jesus.
Micah was quarantined tonight.
Was he?
Yeah, Micah's the only not sick one, and he's not here.
Yeah, what's up with that?
What the f, Micah? All right, let's leave it there. Thank you, Nate.
All right, thank you, guys.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.